keeping you current on all things criminal. This is Crime Feed. Crime Feed. With Darren Kevinoki and Lonnie Coombs.
Welcome once again to Investigation Discovery's Crime Feed podcast. I'm Darren Kevinoki.
And I'm Lonnie Coombs.
And together we are covering the ripped from the headlines cases that everybody is talking about.
And remember, we do this every week. Yes, so we tune in every week, come back and listen for more.
And do not be bashful about telling your friends about it. Of course, you can find us on the Twitter thing at and use at ID Crime Feed. And of course, the hashtag Crime Feed Podcast is what we're going to be looking out for.
Mm-hmm.
And share out there. Use that social media.
Yes, we all love our social media. Find us everywhere.
So let's jump right in, Lonnie, shall we?
Let's start with Slender Man. Now, this is a case that occurred back in May. Three 12-year-old girls were involved. Two girls plotted and planned for many months to kill their friend, another 12-year-old. Essentially, they wanted to sacrifice her to win the favor of a fictional internet character called Slender Man. And that's where most of us adults, I think, started to learn about this strange character named Slender Man. This is out of Wisconsin. Now, what's been going on? They did arrest the two 12-year-old suspects. The victim lived, so we're talking about an attempt murder charge, but it's been up to the judge to decide whether to try these two young girls as juveniles or as adults. And the judge just decided he's going to keep these two girls in adult court rather than juvenile court.
But what was the rationale for that decision? Because I think that's really the thing that's most interesting about this particular case.
Yeah, the judge really looked into this and said, look, I'm worried that if they stay in the juvenile system, essentially they'll be free and clear at the age of 18 with no oversight and no more treatment. Now, 18 is very young.
Right. Well, and this is one of the things that, look, people were stunned by this particular case. It seems so brutal and so violent for these 12-year-old girls.
And so devious.
And premeditated.
Yes.
And there's a lot about this that's truly awful as they're trying to offer up their friend to as an offering to this fictional internet meme, the Slender Man. But for people to keep in mind that when we're talking about juvenile court, that the laws are going to vary from state to state. But one of the features about juvenile court cases is that there's an outer limit in terms of the punishment, where juvenile offenders essentially age out of juvenile court punishment and oversight. And about the latest I've seen in looking at the various states is in California, we've
right.
got 25.
25 to life.
If you
25 years
25
old.
Years
yeah.
old. So if you commit a crime that stays in the juvenile court, the longest you're going to remain in custody is until the age of 25.
Regardless of how heinous the crime is,
right.
even a murder case or an attempted murder case, like this attempted murder charge, in adult court, these girls are looking at 65 years maximum. Whereas, as this judge said, he's worried that if they stay in the juvenile, they'll be out at the age of 18 in 6 years.
But here's the thing that's troubling to me about this, and I'm not a lawyer in Wisconsin, but where this case originates, but the thing that's really bothersome to me is the judge's comments that he's recommending that they get tried in adult court because he doesn't want them to age out of the system at 18. That's not saying that they are fit and proper subjects for adult court. What the judge is really saying is he wants to have the opportunity to hit them with a more extreme or longer lasting punishment. And that to me sounds like a judge that's manipulating the outcome because he doesn't like the law. That is, if the real problem is how long are we punishing juvenile offenders, the answer isn't, even though they're juveniles, let's call them adults. The answer is, let's change the law about how we deal with juvenile offenders.
I don't think you can put it in such little boxes like that, though, Darren. I think that really what the judge is saying here is, look, one factor is that they would age out, apparently, in this state at the age of 18. But the other part is because this crime is so heinous, because it was so premeditated. The strange thing is you're talking about 12-year-olds, so they have this side to them like that they believe this fictional character was alive, but on the other hand, they are doing extremely dangerous adult things like planning how to kill, whether we should stab her in the neck, you know, while she's sleeping, or take her to a bathroom in the park where there's a drain so the blood will drain down. It won't be so messy for us to clean up. Or, hey, let's go take her out to play hide and go seek and stab her there. And interestingly enough, the judge also released some of the tapes of these girls after they were arrested, and they gave some statements. And one of the girls said, look, I thought I'd feel remorse, but I don't. I don't have any. And one more thing, they asked, how many times did you stab her? And she goes, I don't know. I didn't know I was supposed to count.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
so chilling. I mean, do you want this girl out at the age of 18 living next to you?
Well, I got to admit, I've got a bit of attention here because my knee-jerk reaction is, of course not. These are really, really troubled young people and engaged in behavior that is truly horrific. And yet, at the same time, one of the fundamental recognitions about the juvenile court system is that youthful offenders, for a variety of reasons, their brains not being fully mm-hmm. developed, their emotions not being fully developed, being chief among them, they're different and they're to be treated different. So as much as I'm offended by the idea of that level of callousness, on the other hand, what else do you expect from people that are immature, have and who are legally recognized as being different? And as a matter of fact, in Wisconsin, these girls are 12. If they were just a couple of years younger, mm-hmm. they wouldn't even be old enough for juvenile court, because people that are 10 or under, I believe, in Wisconsin are deemed basically incapable of committing crimes because they're so youthful. And so here we're talking about these girls who really aren't far beyond that. So,
well, tell that to the parents of the young girl who almost died and really, I mean, based on her wounds, should have died. It's a miracle she lived.
No,
so.
Thank God she's, I mean, yeah. It's obviously it's not a simple issue. So. But speaking of not simple issues, let's talk about Donald Sterling. Mm. No small appetite for litigation
no.
on the part of Mr. Sterling. And everybody, of course, remembers the undoing of Donald Sterling and the Clippers basketball organization. Sterling, of course, putting himself back in court again, now filing a civil lawsuit against V. Stiviano, she of that great face shield, sunglass.
Yes.
That
I always
never
picture
really got
that.
Caught
I know. And on
yes.
the roller skates.
Well, Sterling is suing V. Stiviano and also TMZ. And this is all based on those recordings that went viral and in Sterling's mind really were the catalyst
undoing.
For that, for his undoing, exactly. And the nature of the allegations are that either Stiviano herself or her agents surreptitiously, secretly recorded him and then sold that recording to TMZ. And more than that, somebody, either Stiviano or somebody in her camp or TMZ, altered those recordings to make him sound what worse than he already sounded before they were broadcast. So Lonnie, from a legal standpoint, we're seeing more and more of this issue of recording, because everybody wants to record everything.
That's right.
Smartphones are everywhere. People are concerned about documenting stuff mm-hmm. and taking videos and recording stuff. So what's from a legal standpoint,
nowadays,
what's the deal?
Nowadays, when you want to prove anything, people are like, where's the recording? Where's the videotape? Where's the audio tape? So a lot of people are doing it more, and it's so easy to do with your cell phone, which you have on you. Well, it's very important to know the law before you do this.
Which, of course, is going to vary from state to state.
Yes, but here for the Donald Sterling in California. California is a two-party consent state, which is, you know, you hear this two-party consent. What that means is that both people, parties to the conversation, must agree to be recorded. And this is a conversation, you know, whether it's just, you know, we're sitting here talking or we're on the phone, we both have to know that it's being recorded and we both have to agree to allow that to happen. Now, what happens if you do one of these recordings and one of the parties has not consented to it? Not only can you not ever use that recording as evidence in a hearing in the courtroom, but you, the person who recorded it, can actually be sued criminally and civilly.
Right.
So it's very, you have to be very careful. Now, if it's considered for a confidential communication, which you have to decide, would reasonable people believe that it was confidential? Usually if it's a telephone call, you assume it's going to be private. If you're in a loud restaurant with other people around, there's a question. You can argue that maybe it wasn't confidential.
And that's it becomes very factually sensitive.
Right. And that's one of the things that V. Stiviano's attorney here has claimed and said, look, her sister was apparently part of the conversation, so he had no right to privacy. Now they still have to be able to prove that. The other thing is consent. V. Stiviano said, saying he consented to her recording these things. He knew that she was recording and that he consented. He, of course, is saying, no way, I never would have consented to that being recorded.
Right. Well, and what's fascinating about this is I think Sterling, of course, is not well loved, right? I mean,
yeah.
He was one of the most hated, certainly taking lots of hits in the court of public opinion.
Based on what he was saying.
Some awful, hateful, disgusting things. And then, of course, he didn't help his cause by going and doing some of those follow-up interviews.
Right.
That may have been felony stupid on the part of his advisors or lack of control or what have you. But the fact is that even though the Clippers were sold for that huge windfall profit, I mean, they sold for $2 billion. Doesn't he still have an argument that he was damaged? He got some pretty hefty fines from the NBA.
Well, that's the other thing you have to be able to prove if you're going to bring this lawsuit civilly. Now, criminally, if you do this recording illegally, you can be fined up to $2,500, or you can even be put into jail for up to a year, so it's a misdemeanor. Civilly, you can be sued for the amount of $5,000 or three times the amount of any actual damages sustained. So,
right. So if his actual damages were in the millions...
But see, V. Stiviano's attorney is saying, hey, what damage? You got $2 billion out of this. And he's saying, wait a minute, the NBA fined me $2.5 million as a fine. Plus, look at all the damage to my reputation. I lost the team that I loved and right. I didn't want to give up.
And maybe he didn't want to sell the thing.
He's still fighting over that.
Right. And he's one of his claims also is that he still hasn't been paid the money
out of the
that
$2
he's due from that $2 billion. Yeah. So
I think under community property, he gets like, you know, $1 billion of that, right?
I think somebody's got some big checks they've got to write to Sterling, but he's such an unpopular plaintiff.
Yeah.
You wonder if he gets in front of a jury, are people going to just hate him and go against him just because he's so reviled?
Yeah, but in this case, it's interesting because I don't think people like to be recorded without knowing about it. Remember when you used to hear the beeps on phones?
Right.
Beep. Okay, that actually is to let you know that you're being recorded. So if you hear a beep, you know, you can say, hey, am I being recorded? I don't want to do this. So while people may not like him, Donald Sterling, I actually think, one, he has a legitimate basis here for the charges. And two, I could see a jury saying, hey, I wouldn't want to be in that situation. There's certain conversations I have that I might not want to have recorded and spread all over. So they might stick up for the law as
right.
opposed to being sticking
well,
up for
Donald.
Well,
and you wonder about TMZ. And where, because they're named in this lawsuit
right.
as well, and of course their reach is far and wide.
Oh boy!
But how much are they loving the coverage of this? I wonder.
Well, I'm telling you, and TMZ, if you ever want the quickest response to any rumor out there, you know they're always there with a picture, with audio tape, with videotape. They seem to be able to get their hands on these things.
You know, the one thing that was interesting to me as I was doing research for this story, I was looking for the actual lawsuit. Surprisingly. Yeah, not on the TMZ website.
Oh, really? That's surprising. The one thing that's not in there. All right, let's move on to a more serious situation that's going on in Ferguson, Missouri, as we remember.
We just had an important anniversary.
An anniversary of Michael Brown's death, and there were a number of community members there who wanted to have some peaceful protests to signify the anniversary and also highlight some of the changes that they feel still need to be made. And so the protests started out peacefully enough. During the day, going marching from, you know, churches to the courthouse. But in the evening, they got out of hand the first night. There were shots fired. There was one person in critical injury, you know, who's in the hospital, who's now been charged for firing on police officers. There was, you know, some looting, some things going on. And so a state of emergency was declared. The next day, there were some more protests. And then showing up to the surprise of many people were five white men carrying military style rifles and sidearms, wearing camouflage gear and bulletproof vests. And the protesters were wondering, who are these people coming into our community? Why are they joining us? And they went up and asked them what's going on. And they said, well, we're here to protect a reporter who's here covering the protests from some, you know, right wing website. But then some of them also told other protesters, hey, we're here to protect you. We're on your side of the protesters. So everybody was saying, what are they doing here? It caused a lot of tensions to rise, and people are saying, wait a minute, how can they just walk in with these, you know, assault rifles slung over their shoulder into a very incendiary situation? And the police didn't do anything about it.
Right. Well, and this is a group that has dubbed themselves the Oath Keepers.
Right.
And of course, what's interesting is under Missouri law, they are allowed to carry weapons as long as these weapons aren't being brandished in a threatening manner.
Yeah.
And so the wondering here, Lonnie, is whether in this context the brandishing of any weapons mm-hmm. could be construed as being in a threatening manner.
Well, and I think you have to look at the context. Now, the Oath Keepers themselves describe themselves as a nonpartisan association made up of current and former U.S. soldiers, police officers, first responders who are there to protect the U.S. Constitution.
Right.
The Southern Poverty Law Center says they are a fiercely anti-government militaristic group. And they're walking into this situation where people aren't sure. I mean, they're outside the community. They're not there necessarily as part of the protests. And they're saying, we feel a little threatened by the right. fact that you have these guns that you're carrying so openly and in such a, you know, a militaristic way with your camouflage gear, with your bulletproof vest. And I think that rightfully so, people, it made them feel intimidated. It made them feel nervous. And some of them, it made them feel threatened.
But, you know, it's an interesting debate because on the one hand, there's a certain logical appeal to the idea that if criminals know that everybody is armed and people are carrying guns in a very open fashion, that crime will be deterred because criminals will say, hey, look, I'm not going to carry out criminal misdeeds in this area where everybody's armed and I could end up being shot. And yet I also see how on the other side of that argument, how if you're just, you know, walking your kid to school, you don't necessarily want to see people that are openly carrying guns.
Yeah.
That certainly doesn't necessarily inspire a feeling of safety.
Well, you know, this goes all back, obviously, to the Second Amendment. And there's the whole fundamental debate of whether the Second Amendment was really meant to, you know, make sure that our militia was armed,
right,
or that private individuals were armed. And
exactly.
Here it's very interesting. You kind of see this clash because you see the police officers there all armed, you know, to try and watch over the protesters and make sure that, you know, it all stays calm and peaceful. And then you have these private citizens come up with their guns, and it's like, do they really have a place here? And do we really want to turn society into where, you know, that the one scenario you gave where everybody is carrying their guns as they go, you know, to do their grocery shopping? Or, you know, I mean, I think that any mother who's walking their, you know, preschool kids to nursery school that morning and has people walking by, you know, there are other countries where people walk around with their, you know, their guns sling over their arm just down the street, and people are used to that. I think in our society, they're going to take that as a more threatening presence.
Yeah, and you know, I have to admit to feeling a certain sense of conflict on this. I'm a gun owner, and especially after a recent visit I had to Israel, where I went to the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem and saw how some of the most horrific atrocities committed against mankind were allowed to advance at a much more rapid rate because the citizenry was unable to properly resist. And it really left me with the feeling of, hey, as it's a responsible act to be a gun owner and to be able to defend my family against an appropriate threat. And yet I can't help but feel that on the other side of it, there's this great quote from Wayne Dyer, mm-hmm. if you're familiar, a noted author and brilliant thinker, who said that fighting for peace makes as much sense as fornicating for virginity.
Right.
That there's a
right.
fundamental misalignment that you're going to get more peace by adding more guns
exactly.
and violence in the
to
mix.
To me, that seems so logical. And while I understand that, you know, you see some reasonableness to have guns to protect your family in that small, isolated context, that's not what, you know, people start there and then they end up saying, well, I want to have it in my car because you never know if there might be a person as I'm yeah. driving down the street who's going to do, you know, and then everybody has guns as opposed to, and guns lead to violence. I mean, they do.
Of course. But the problem, Lonnie, is that if your mantra is going to be make love, not war, that only helps if you're hanging out with a bunch of people who are also aligned, because the people that want to make war will take advantage of the fact.
Exactly. And that's the problem. You know, we have to decide, you know, with our laws, are we going to be in a society where nobody has guns or everybody has guns? And that includes, apparently in our society, people who allegedly aren't supposed to have guns, but people with records and people with mental illness seem to be able to get the guns pretty easily. All right, next case. Here's a 62-year-old man in Missouri who has been serving life in prison without any possibility of parole. And you may ask, what did he do?
It must be some horrific crime.
You would think so. Back in 1993, he attempted to buy 6 pounds of marijuana in a sting operation. And because he had 2 prior marijuana charges, he was sentenced under the state's 3 strikes law, which said he was a repeat offender, a prior and persistent drug offender. And so the judge had no other alternative but to sentence him to life without the possibility of parole. He's now spent 20 years in prison. But the governor just commuted his life sentence, and so he's actually going to get out this year after spending 20 years for trying to buy some pot.
Trying to buy 6 pounds of weed. You know, I'm so troubled by mandatory sentencing in general that it deprives judges and prosecutors with the opportunity to craft outcomes that are really custom tailored to an individual situation. And this story is such a perfect example where the judge here says, look, my hands are tied. I've got this mandatory sentence that I've got to deliver. And especially when we're talking about these drug cases, it seems to me that the fundamental thing that is broken is the lack of meaningful treatment that is provided to people that are incarcerated for drug offense. And I mean, as a separate issue, what is it about the world of drugs that continues to show up for people as an opportunity? And it's such an enormous problem in our criminal justice system.
Well, yeah, let me give you some numbers here. Weed-related offenses accounted for about half of all drug crimes, and there were more arrests in the United States for marijuana possession in 2011 than for all violent crimes combined. That's according to the FBI Uniform Crime Report. And here's another thing that's also concerned a lot of people for many years, and that is the major racial disparities that play out in these drug-related crimes. The ACLU found that although black people and white people used pot around the same rate, blacks were nearly 4 times more likely than whites to be arrested for marijuana during the years examined. Now, I think that we, even though I'm on the prosecution side and you come from the defense side, I think we both recognize that these changes, like the governor's done here and like President Obama has been doing, especially over the last few years of
commuting nonviolent drug offenders.
Yeah, you know, he just commuted the sentence of another 46 men and women. And then there's another change where they're lowering some of the mandatory sentencing that's going to let out a whole bunch more other people, nonviolent offenders. I think it's time. But you and I are old enough to know the history of this. When 3 strikes came into effect, we're both practicing, and it came in because we would look back at, you know, early criminal records of people, they would get 6 years on a murder case. I mean, crazy things. And you'd see them again and say, wait a minute, they have, you know, a murder in their you know, background, a manslaughter, and here they come again. The sentencing seemed to be so light. And so people came up with this thing called 3 strikes, thinking, okay, if people have, you know, this history, then we can really get them on the third offense. But very quickly, we saw, I think, on both sides of the criminal justice system that it really ended up giving a lot of really unfair sentences to people. And it's taken a while for state by state to decide that they were going to wipe out 3 strikes.
Well, you know, when you start talking about something like 3 strikes, which is a really great, it's just such a great slogan, and it's got such great shorthand qualities to it. But when you really look at how it was applied, there was such disparity in the geography, where there were some counties that took an almost perverse pride in the number of people that they had sentenced to a life term in prison. And there are some really absurd, ridiculous results where mostly upon people who are economically disadvantaged, homeless people, or I should say formerly homeless people that now have a lifelong home in state prison because they had these old prior strike offenses, and then they pick up some horrific new offense like shoplifting a piece of pizza from a food cart.
Yeah.
And that guy, which is a real case, a guy who stole, a homeless guy, hungry, steals a slice of pizza, and that guy is now in prison for 25 years to life. Another homeless guy who had shoplifted a shaving kit from a Kmart doing 25 years to life. It's so ridiculous to me, mm-hmm. and it's all a byproduct of mandatory sentencing laws.
Yeah.
Which since then there have been some corrections about the third strike being a serious or violent felony and not just any felony, and that certainly has helped to smooth things out. But I think when we're talking about some of these drug offenses, yeah. like this guy with the 6 pounds of marijuana, I think the trend that is afoot with the decriminalization of marijuana for both medical and in some states even recreational use, I think our grandkids are going to look at how we're dealing with drug offenders much in the same way we look at people, you know, from the 20s with prohibition and scratch our heads and say, what the hell were they thinking?
Well, let's hope, because, you know, we're spending billions of dollars, you know, to incarcerate all these people. And that money could be taken and put in treatment programs, like right. you talked about, to actually help people with the drug issues.
So. Right. So that we can actually attack recidivism, which is a major, major problem yeah. since roughly 2/3 of people who are incarcerated for crimes actually reoffend.
Yeah.
And how often do we see this, that they don't get help for the fundamental problem that allows them to offend in the first place, which is their thinking. You know, we lock people up for taking the action, but the action is the symptom. The real problem is the underlying thinking that says, oh, I can commit this crime and it's a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's some violent criminals that do need to go away, but obviously there's a lot of other ones. Our prison systems are so overwhelmed right now. We need to...
Mandatory sentencing yeah. removes the discretion.
Right.
All right.
All right. Let's talk about some cases we're keeping our eye on. I've been watching this one case. It's a very sad case, but as I always say, it seems like the most violence seems to occur in the family law courts, even more violence than in the criminal courtrooms. And this is one example of it.
That's right. Wait, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Len, but isn't that the old saying that in criminal court, you get bad people on their best behavior, and in family law court, you get good people on their worst.
And you know what? That's a very good way of putting it. I mean, I think that people, whenever you get involved in a situation where a court system and a judge and other people have control over your kids and the way you're going to parent them, and if you're going to be able to see them, people's emotions run high and their best judgment goes out the window. Well, that's what happened in this case in Vermont. 40-year-old woman named Jody Herring, mother of a 9-year-old daughter, she had just had the court take her daughter away from her, and so she decided to take it out on the social worker who had been involved. So she waited for the social worker to come out of work, and right there, as they were walking in the parking lot, she shot her with a rifle, and as the victim went down, she then shot her again at close range.
Oh, my God.
Luckily, there was a state attorney general who used to be in the military who was nearby. He heard the gunshots. He came, and he wrestled the gun out of her hands, so we don't even know if it might have been even worse. So she was taken in. She's arrested. She's been charged with the first-degree murder of this young woman, the social worker, who everyone said was just a wonderful advocate for children. She really, you know, put the children first as opposing to, you know, throwing them back in with the parents, even though it might not have been a safe situation. But the other part of this is apparently there were 3 other bodies that were found close in time, 2 cousins and an aunt of this woman, of Jody Herring. And the police say they're working on that investigation. But apparently she had called and left them some messages saying to her cousins, stop making comments or stop making calls to the DCSF or something will happen. And now they were found dead. So the investigation's ongoing. There'll probably be some charges coming in the future, but very, very sad situation for everyone involved.
Wow. Well, I'm keeping my eye on a case that's a little bit more fun. Not by much, I suppose, for the people that are involved. This is a civil lawsuit. This is a guy who is suing his ex-girlfriend, saying that she illegally stole his sperm and had a baby with it. Also, of course, involved in this is the sperm bank. So here's the backstory on this. This gentleman, last name is Harden, had a relationship with a woman named Kathy LeBlanc, who was actually the mother of his first son. And he ended up having a vasectomy, but thought, you know what, before I have this little procedure, we may want to have some more kids. So he froze several vials of his sperm. And then they wrote up a contract which said that no matter what, that sperm would go to Kathy LeBlanc, the girlfriend.
Okay.
Right? So then they break up.
Yeah.
It's tragic. These things happen. And then, of course, Harden starts dating another woman named Toby Duvall. And then the two of them go to the sperm bank at least one time together. Apparently, I guess, to
make a
bring Ms. Duvall. Yes, exactly. To make a withdrawal from the sperm bank. Thank you. And then cue the evil music. Then afterwards, Ms. Duvall goes by herself, picks up some sperm, and got pregnant with it. So wow. Now, yes. So Duvall says that she had Harden's permission to do this, and Harden says, no way. Now Harden and LeBlanc, who was the original girlfriend and the mother of Harden's child, they are both suing the new girlfriend Duvall and the sperm bank.
Ooh.
And this is a trial that is starting now. What's amazing is that the child that was produced is now 5 years old.
Oh my goodness.
And has not had any contact with his biological father.
Wow.
It's an amazing, it brings up so many interesting legal issues.
Yeah. This is so fertile for so many different legal issues. But the interesting thing is, you know, if you look at it just based on the law, well, it's the contract. The contract's very clear of where this sperm was supposed to go and who had the rights to it. But you're talking about a child.
Well, but is the sperm bank also a party to the contract? Were they aware of it? Obviously, there's some factual sensitivity here. But if you talk to this guy, Harden, and he's saying, hey, look, there's more security and protocols in place to buy a bottle of booze at the liquor store or a pack of cigarettes than there is at the sperm bank.
Well,
and what about
that's
now?
That's scary.
Yeah, it is scary.
You might want to think about that, where you're putting your sperm. And, you might want to check out their security system first.
What about child support and all those other kinds of obligations that can arise? And how is it that the sperm bank is just so plain, so fast and loose with this guy's seed?
Absolutely.
So,
and, you know, and then, you know, in 5 years when this child says, hey, I want to meet you, Daddy, what does he say?
No.
No? I mean, how could you? Oh, that's a tough.
But let's talk about one of our favorites here.
Our favorite part of the show.
Dumbest criminals.
Dumbest criminals. Hashtag.
Yes, it's a little competition that, frankly, I don't.
That I always win.
Seem to be faring so well with. Yes, a competition between Lonnie and me to see who can find the dumbest criminal activity of the week. By the way, I'm begging you people. I'm getting my clock cleaned here. So feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and send me some ideas. Yeah. Por
favor. You know what? I'm not even going to argue with that anymore. Go ahead. Send him all the
tweet at us at @IDCrimeFeed. And for this, you can use the hashtag
dumbest criminals.
Yes, please. Or just send him directly to me at Darren Cavanoghi. But and what do you got this week, Lonnie?
I got a good one.
Is that out of Florida?
No.
If it's out of Florida, I'm losing.
I know. This one actually is out of California, of all places.
Ah.
I call this my Thelma and Louise
case. Wait, is this one of my clients?
I hope not. No, I don't think so. Okay, there's a gal named Crystal Evans, 26 years old, who's on probation. And part of her probation is she has to provide mandatory urine samples whenever they ask. So she had provided one, but she was nervous about it testing positive. So she decides in her brilliance that she is going to go to the DHL delivery van, that's kind of like the FedEx, that is carrying her urine sample away, and she's going to dig through and find her sample and take it. So she goes with a friend of hers, her Thelma and Louise, Denise McClure, and they are digging through all of the items in this DHL.
But they have to break into the truck?
They're in the truck when the driver comes up, catches them, calls the police. They're caught. So they're arrested for destruction of evidence. And ironically, the funny thing is the sample that she was trying to steal tested negative.
Oh, it was clean.
But when she was arrested, she had to give a sample.
And
that one came back positive for meth.
No.
So after all, she violated her probation.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my. God,
good
you
one,
are
huh?
a rough act to follow. All right. Let me see what I can do here. So I've got one for about a 27-year-old man who shows up for his driving test.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you need to loosen up. And he shows up for his driving test smelling of alcohol. Although he insisted to the instructor that he had had nothing to drink, he apparently proceeded to drive erratically, at which point the driving instructor directed him to pull into a parking lot which happened to be at a police station.
Smart instructor.
An investigation ensued, and the man was booked for driving with a blood alcohol content that was 3 times the legal limit.
Wow.
And I guess as a poignant afterthought, he did not pass his driving test.
Getting
arrested during your driving test will cause you to fail that test.
He got his first DUI without even having a license.
I don't even think we put this one to a vote. I got to concede defeat. Okay, listen, ID addicts, please help a brother out here. You got to help me get one of these dumbest criminals. It's just unfair.
Yeah, I that's fine. You can go ahead. Send them all to Darren.
Well, I've got to say, Lonnie, it's always a pleasure talking about these ripped from the headlines cases. And on behalf of my partner in crime,
Lonnie Coombs.
Yes, I know you. And of course, you know me, Darren Cavanocchi. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, if you want more shocking true crime stories, there's only one place to go, and that is Investigation Discovery, or...
Or you can go to the visitthecrimefeed.com.
That sounds like a plan. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week.
Keeping you current on all things criminal. Crime Feed.
Crime Feed.
With Darren Cavanocchi and Lonnie Coombs.